This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Finally, with the nicer weather, most of us are spending more time outdoors and we're paying more attention to the shape of our yards, trees, and gardens. Joining us to discuss how to get our lawns and gardens growing well and looking good, and to answer your questions, are Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Peter and David, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, by the way, thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's right, a rain gauge. That's going to come in quite handy.
I think they're kind of invaluable. If you're a gardener, I don't know how many times I've listened to the weather reports and they'll say, well, so-and-so got 2 inches of rain in this part and I didn't get any. And we know that summer thunderstorms are very spotty and, you know, our plants need 1 inch of water per week. And when they don't get it, if you want to supplement, you'll know exactly how much you got and whether you need to water, yourself or not. So I think they're kind of fun.
It's a handy tool for gardeners. I know exactly where I'm going to put mine in, and it's going to go up there tonight. So thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it. Peter, good to see you. It's the day after Memorial Day, and a lot of people are starting to do more work in their yards and their gardens. And what kind of things should they be focusing on this time of year when it comes to the lawn and it comes to the garden?
Well, with the vegetable gardening, what we want to do is to – well, I mean, a lot of people are pretty far in to already have their gardens planted. But what you want to do is to clear the garden, your beds first of weeds so that they don't become an ongoing problem during the summer. And this is also a time when you're actually planting your plants, particularly bedding plants. You can do side dressings of compost and organic fertilizers to help ensure a healthy growth through the cycle of the summer.
David, what's your advice for this time of year?
You know, I think there's still a lot of people that haven't planted their tomatoes and peppers and eggplant and some of those things yet. One of the things that I have started to do that I haven't done a lot of in the past is applying a liquid starter fertilizer on my transplants. And you can do that with fish emulsion or blood meal or an organic source, or you can use the miracle type products. And it really seems to get your plants off to a very quick, healthy start. And I'm starting to do that more and more, and I can really tell a difference in the plants that I start with a starter fertilizer and those that I don't.
So it's not too late to start that vegetable garden.
Not at all. We've got a lot of growing season left. And as a matter of fact, I've had calls from people telling me that their tomatoes and their peppers and eggplants aren't really growing like they think they should. And honestly, we haven't had those real warm night temperatures and the humidity and the heat that these plants really prefer. And I know we're going to get it, but we haven't had it so far. So I think it's, being real early this year, unless you had, use some sort of a covering or a heat control type of device, you weren't really money ahead because plants going into cold soil and in cold conditions just don't grow that well.
Peter, what are some good vegetables to put out this time of year?
Well, like Dave said, you always think of like after the days of the last frost around Mother's Day, is you put out your peppers and tomatoes and so forth. But you can the thing that's important is when you talk about when you start a garden is that we actually have kind of three growing seasons. So you have early spring, mid season, and your fall, or sometimes called cold crops. And so I always tell people it's never too late to plant. Maybe November is, but any time during the summer you can start. And certain plants also, like you plant your peas and spinach and some early cool weather vegetables early in the spring, and then as you harvest those, you wait and you don't plant them again until for your fall crop. So you may do another round of those and sowing those seeds in late July and early August with the idea of harvesting them into the fall. So there's you can look at rotation too.
Okay, and when you're talking about the various seasons, that's succession gardening? Is that what that's?
Yeah, that's what you would call it, succession gardening. And succession gardening can mean, too, and sometimes when people plant, say if you're planting bush beans, every 3 weeks people will replant another crop, so they extend it over, several cycles. But then the other way is just a succession of actual crops. Early crops of brassicas like your kale, and cabbage and kohlrabis, you can plant early in the spring and harvest during the summer, and then you pull all those plants and you don't plant them, say, like during July, and then you replant them in early August or at the end of July for a fall crop, because during that mid-season is where you have a lot of problems with the pests that really like those vegetables.
And Peter, you were talking about getting the weeds out of your gardens and your flower beds. And David, I think one time you'd mentioned that just scraping the tops of the weeds with a hoe versus digging down
as effective. Get your weeds when they're young. Don't let them get, and obviously you always want to get them before they go to seed, but just scraping that top and keeping after that. And there are some wonderful hoes that have been developed. Actually, they're probably very old world type hoes, but we've really started to reintroduce these things. And I think I always told the story about how I worked on the university farm, and the farm crew would come in during lunch hour, eat their lunch, and then they would sharpen their hoes before they went back out into the field. And, you know, a sharp hoe can really save you a lot of time.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Charlie from Mount Carmel had called. He has a problem with moles going on. Mm-hmm. And he says, what can you do this time of year? Is it the time to use Grub-X?
You can. You're going to treat the grubs, and you're going to be able to eradicate some of their food source. However, a major part of the mole's food supply are earthworms, and you don't want to do anything to harm them. And so they're still going to continue to feed. A lot of people mistakenly believe that because they see so many tracks and throughout their yard that they have a lot of moles. Well, one mole can do a tremendous amount of damage, and trapping is pretty effective. If you can eradicate but with trapping, that actually works pretty well. There are some other things. There's a impregnated worm with a rodenticide in it that can be put into the hole, and it has to be carefully done, and the mole will think it's an earthworm, feed on it, and it will kill them that way. But you want to be real careful with that. And I've had people tell me they have the best dog in the world that will go after them, pull that mole out of there, kill it, and will not tear up the yard. But and I've actually had a dog like that, and they are invaluable, but sometimes they do more damage than the mole does.
Peter, you have any advice on the mole problem?
Well, for me, I mean, they're disruptive in the garden, but they also aerate the soil. I may have a very short fuse with raccoons, but I have a tendency to be a little bit more understanding with moles. And so I don't really treat them as a problem unless it becomes extremely disruptive. I do know that sometimes if you plant a row of corn and they will like follow that row where you trenched and like pop all the corn out. It's not that they're eating it, but you just kind of create this mole superhighway. So those types of things are extremely frustrating. But we garden in a lot of urban gardens in the city, and even our place on Gray Road, it's the moles aren't really a destructive problem for us.
Are they worse than usual this year, David?
I don't think so. The one thing that's the positive of them is they really prefer good soils, really high organic content soils and lighter soils. They don't like clay as much. They don't like the cultivation that Peter was talking about. They do like the sod. And of course, one of the other things that people sometimes attribute to moles is skunk damage, they usually come out 3-4 in the morning, and they will tear the sod up from the top down, and they can be just tremendously destructive.
Now, I have a friend who started some lettuce seeds inside, and it says it looked like they were doing well, and they put them outside when it was in the 80s, and a lot of these lettuce seeds died off. Now, what happened with that? Is that shock?
They just weren't acclimated to that intense sunlight, the wind, and it's really best if you can slowly acclimate those to the outdoor conditions before you throw them, just out there at one time. Cold frames can be really beneficial and helpful in those kind of situations, but generally, anytime that you're growing something indoors, you're just not going to have the light intensity that is these plants require. And then when you throw them out into that intense sunlight, you're going to get some burning and death.
Yeah, and it basically, too, if you think about a lot of commercial farmers, whether it be market gardeners, smaller farms, what they'll actually put out floating row cover over younger plants. And what that does, it provides kind of a shading and cooling. But hardening the plant off, like Dave talked about, is really important. Like tomatoes, peppers, anything that you're going to transplant out, you know, put them in dappled light or part sun, part shade for a couple days, for a couple hours, and build up over a period of time and acclimate the plant to the outside. If you just take it and put it in full sun, it just burn up.
Okay. That's just asking for trouble, it sounds like. Yeah. Yeah. And we got an email from Rachel who said she just moved into a new house, doesn't have as much sunlight as her old place did. So she's planting some new beds with hostas and such, but she wants to add in some splashes of color. And she's asking about the shade-tolerant flowers. What would you guys recommend?
Well, the one that always comes to mind used to be one of the biggest sellers out there, of course, Impatiens. That's strictly an annual, but boy, if you want to spot a color here and there in your garden, you can get any kind of color with them, white, red, pink, orange, you name it. And they just are extremely attractive. Begonias would also work. And of course, there's really a host of perennials that do flower in the shade, and shade tolerant ones that she could go to a good nursery and they'd help her select those.
You could also talk to some people that are familiar with the native plants. I know at home in some shady areas we have, there's a native ginger plant, which is sort of a heart-shaped leaf that hugs the ground and has a little brownish, little fuzzy flower that's underneath the leaves. It's not showy. But then there's also a yellow woodland poppy, which its botanical name is escaping me right now, but it's a native plant. But if you check with someplace like Keystone Flora in Windshoe Hollow or any of the native plant, Wild Ones is a good organization to contact. They can give you some information on different native plants that work well in the woodland shade situation.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And does it make sense to put some potted plants outdoors in the summer, bring them back in the fall? Is that...
Well, I always do. My wife loves to grow gardenias, and then we have some limes and lemons that are potted, and they just love their summer vacation outdoors, and they thrive during the summer. And then unfortunately, we got to bring them back in, and they deteriorate for, you know, months until we can get them back outside. But it's just amazing that the new growth that they all have on them right now, and flowers, and just, you know, I always take them out.
Yeah, I think also, it's like you said, it's a shot of pure fresh air, sunlight. Rainwater is really good for plants. And often if you're having problems with aphids or some different problems indoors, when you put them out and they're exposed to sunlight and better ventilation, those problems either dissipate or go away.
You know, that's exactly. I have had that experience where you just assume that when you bring your plants back inside from being outdoors, you need to treat them with insecticides. I found, you know, and maybe that's a good idea, but when I take mine out for the summer, I find birds on them and all kinds of predators feeding on those insects, the scale insects and everything else. And I never treat because I really know that the predators are going to take care of it.
So the bugs and the insects aren't as big of a worry when you put them outside.
No,
and bring them back.
I haven't found them to be, okay. No.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And we will continue that conversation with our horticulture experts, David Kester and Peter Huttinger. You can join us again, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Here to answer your questions about gardening are Peter Huttinger, a co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of the Community Gardening Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, who's the Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Peter, you've got some interesting information about summer camps.
Yeah, there's a number of organizations in town that do summer camps that are either gardening-based or nature-based. And I think that It's really kind of an interesting what's taken place over the last several years, the movement in terms of outdoor education. There was the book, Leave No Child Let Inside. But then there's also, for a number of years, I've been interested in the writing of David Sobel, who's written about children's experiences and experiential-based learning in nature. A really good book by him is Ecophobia. And he also wrote a book about children building forts. But Imago in Price Hill, the Imago Earth Center, has a really nice series of classes, summer camps for children. And one that really kind of caught my attention was called Wild Fun Camp for children 7 to 11. And it's about features kids playing outside in the woods. And it gives them the opportunity to play in the forest and also do fort building and hide-and-seek games and obstacle courses and treasure hunts. And I think that was kind of a really thing. So it's the idea of providing children positive experience in nature. Turner Farm also has a series of children's camps that are really nice. And they deal with the, you know, farm experiences, but also give children the opportunity to experience and be around farm animals. So they kind of see the whole picture of a farm, you know, including livestock and crops and so on and so forth. And so those are really nice series of classes. And Imago, you can reach them through their website, which is imagoearth.org. And their phone number is 513-921-5124. And then Turner Farm, you could reach, get their information at turnerfarm.org. And then there's Home Meadow Song Farm, where my wife and several other people do programming. And it's also experiential based. And there's a number of summer camps there. And that it's homemeadowsongfarm.com or 513-542-1745. And it's a series of classes. Little Red Hen Summer Days is for young children, experiential play, nature play and gardening experiences. And then there's a really great one, Who Will Help Me Bake a Loaf of Bread, where the children work with grains, grinding grains, making dough, making sourdough. And we have a wood fire earthen bread oven that they actually bake the bread in. And so it's all very hands-on, very kind of primary experiences in nature.
It all sounds like a lot of fun, too.
Yeah. And there's other groups, too. Like I would point out the Nature Center and the Civic Garden Center. There's a number of different things. But really look and really ask people if they're experiential-based or immersion-type programs where the children really get to experience nature firsthand as opposed to classroom kit project-oriented projects.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. And let's talk with Carolyn in Western Hills. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Yes, I was calling. I'm having a problem with a morning glory. I've done everything I could possibly think of, from boiling water, pouring it on the glory, as well as using weed killer, and nothing's working. It's just popping up everywhere.
That is a tough weed. When you say weed killer, what have you tried?
Weed killer?
Do you know, is it glyphosate or is it 2,4-D or?
Ooh. No, I wouldn't know.
There are several kinds. The thing that's important is to, when you apply those, to get it on the foliage on a hot, sunny day. The hotter and the sunnier it is, and the longer we go without rainfall to wash it off, the more effective that a product will be. You want to be careful not to sterilize the ground that's in. But morning glories, that is a really tough weed. And I think you may have to repeat applications on it. I suppose you could put down some clear plastic and try to cook it out that way. But the weed killers should be pretty effective on those. But Peter,
Well, it's the bane of my existence. I've pulled my dealt with that stuff. You know, it's an interesting thing. There's a very good chance it's bindweed, which is in the same family. Does it have a small white flower or is it a purple flower?
It's purple.
Okay, then it might be just actually this morning glory or some variety of bindweed also. You know, what I've kind of found in the best, if you try and dig them up, you just break up the roots, and then every little speck has a potential of becoming another plant. So as Dave mentioned earlier in the session, is just take a hoe and just cut it off at ground level and keep repeating that. Now, I don't advocate the use of herbicides, But another thing I've heard about these kind of vining plants, if you do the treatment in the fall, as the plant is receding, it has a tendency to take these chemicals back into their root systems that are more effective. And so you could talk to a horticulture agent or someone who's more familiar with these pesticides to see if that's really true. But there seems to be some logic in that. But, you know, repeated hoeing at surface level is my default position at this point for bindweed and morning glory.
Carolyn, thank you for the call. Let's talk with Zach in Munford Heights. Good afternoon, Zach.
Hello there.
What's your question?
I had just more of a comment. I've been studying Dr. Elaine Ingham's work extensively lately, and there's definitely a paradigm shift that needs to happen as far as an approach to gardening and, well, I guess just land stewardship in general. It's amazing what you can achieve when you get a balance of the biology in the soil. The last caller's problem with an early successionary plant like morning glory could probably be a result of a very early successionary biology in her soil. So if things were improved and encouraged to become more biologically diverse, then weeds no longer become a problem, and plant resistance to diseases, productivity, soil structure building, water holding capacity, all of these things become a result of that. So compost is the answer, really.
I agree with you. I have read a lot of those things, and you know, different weeds tell you different things about your soil and things like that. I deal with a customer base that wants a quick answer, and you know, going that route, which you can achieve certainly, but it isn't as quick as what some people want.
That's true. That is a hurdle.
But I agree with you. It's, the book, Teeming with Microbes. And I mean, people have been like Rodale and the Nearings. I mean, people have been talking about this for decades, if not longer. And, but I think that's really it is in the long term is building up a healthy, vibrant, biologically active, soil will eliminate and create a kind of a balance in the garden or a farm, which really helps control some of these problems. I mean, it's not going to get rid of bindweed completely, but or some of these situations, but it certainly contributes to the long-term solution.
Zach, thank you for the phone call. Jake called and he wanted your thoughts on not putting so much work and effort into lawns versus letting them just go more natural with some sustainable methods.
Sounds good to me. Now, one of the things that you get into is if you are in a neighborhood where there's kind of a competition to have that perfect lawn and you don't, then maybe you've got some weeds going to seed and those will spread to other people's lawns. And I think we put too much emphasis on it. And I, at Kentucky, we really recommend fertilizing only in the fall of the year and mowing frequently enough to keep your, the weeds from going to seed. And I know they follow that same principle in Ohio. It's just that you're a little bit further north, and so you can get by with a little bit of spring fertilization. But I agree. I think that's a healthy attitude.
We're talking with our horticulture experts, Peter Huttinger and David Kester, and they're taking your questions about gardens, plants, flowers, and trees. Thanks to Robin Fegans for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. And let's talk with Daryl in Mount Carmel. Good afternoon, Daryl.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about raspberry plants that the leaves are being eaten. My wife and I have found some little green worms underneath that I think are maybe some kind of fly, some kind of flies in waiting. Anyway, what can we do aside from just picking them off and squashing them?
If they're larvae, the BT should be pretty effective on those. Bacillus thuringiensis, it's also called Dipel BT, it would be really safe to use. It's not a problem to use on those. And, of course, you're still probably a good ways away from harvesting any fruit, but that would work. That particular product would be very effective on the larvae.
Yeah, now what are the names again?
What was the name again?
Oh, I'm sorry. Dipel or BT, Bacillus thuringiensis is the chemical product. It's not actually a chemical, but or Dipel is a trade name. BT, you can get it that way too. Thuricide.
Dipel.
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Daryl. We appreciate the call.
Yeah.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, Rita had called and she has a large pot of milkweed on her balcony. And last year she lost it to aphids. So she's wondering what she can do to get rid of the aphids, but not hurt the butterflies.
I would think insecticidal soap would be pretty good on that. And it's probably going to take more than one application, but and then you can wash the soap off in between applications. But I would think insecticidal soap will do a pretty good job on that.
Actually, with aphids, sometimes you can just spray the plant with a hose and you'll knock them off and they'll go someplace else.
Let's talk with Lindsay in Westchester. Hi, Lindsay.
Hello. Yes, I have a volunteer maple sapling that came up in my mulch bed last year, and I let it grow to get about 30 inches tall, real healthy. So this year I decided to move it out of the mulch bed into the front yard, and I think I worked the soil up pretty good, brought some of the soil with it from the mulch bed, tried to get as many of the roots as I could. Put it in the ground about 2.5 weeks ago. And the whole week after that, it was pretty cloudy and rainy and not terribly warm, so I felt like it was not getting cooked that first week. But I had a little problem with the roots. A beech or a birch tree in the area had sent a bigger root right underneath it, and I couldn't really dig the maple up without chopping off the one sort of main root that it had. I kept about half of it, but I couldn't really extract it from around this larger root that was already there. I'm just having trouble keeping the thing. I water it every day.
Okay.
It just looks like it's going to die on me.
Yeah, anytime you move a plant like that, you're probably leaving up to 80% of the roots still back at the original site. You're not taking those with them. So, and you probably got away with it when it was cool and cloudy, but all of a sudden, those leaves are making on some demands on the roots that the roots can't supply right now with moisture, because they're limited. And, doing what you're doing, continuing to water will help. It would have been better to have done that in the fall of the year when it was dormant and you would have probably gotten away with it, or even in March of this year. But, that was kind of late to do it this year. Usually we only like to move trees when they're dormant.
Lindsay mentioned a volunteer tree. What is that, David?
That's a seedling that came up. Maybe it was from a seed from another maple in the area, fell down into his mulch, germinated, and was coming up, and he just wanted to save it. And a lot of people do that. And the younger you do that on the plant, the better off. But it's tough when it's competing, when you're digging with other competing roots in that area. And then this time of year, you just it's really pretty unsuccessful to move things.
If you want to transplant something out like that, you see a seedling come up. If you plant it into a gallon or larger pot when it's, say, 4, 5, 6 inches tall and let it overwinter or grow for a while inside that pot, that way you can take it out of the pot and you have its complete root ball. When you transplant it out, it's more successful.
Peter, is this still a good time of year, though? Can you still transplant trees and shrubs, or are we just about past the point of no return?
No, a lot of your trees and shrubs are in containers now, and a lot of the nurseries have them balled in burlap, and a lot of those can be re-burlapped and sent out, and no, you can still get away with it if you buy. I would not be digging trees now to move in my yard. I would definitely wait till fall on that. But if you're landscaping, I think by all means go out to your good nursery and buy some plants, and the container ones are just great.
Yeah, you can still plant them this time of year. What David mentioned earlier in the fall, particularly for trees, is because they're going into dormancy and you have that wet weather, moist weather during the summer, over winter. So by the time August comes, they're more established and you don't have to worry about them dehydrating. But this time of year, particularly shrubs, you know, you have to watch them and you make sure you water them on a regular cycle, but you should definitely do it. I mean, next week I'm going to be planting gooseberries and currants. So
I guess the main thing would be do it before it gets too much hotter.
Yeah.
513-419-7100. Let's talk with John in Northside. Hi, John. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I had a question about honeysuckle. I have a large yard, and we have quite a bit of honeysuckle. And I know the best way to eradicate them is to dig them up and get all of the root out. I was wondering if there's an alternative, if I'm able to cut the root down as low as, or cut this trunk down as low as possible, and if there's some sort of paint on herbicide that would prevent it from sprouting back up.
There is. and you can, if you go to your farm supply store or there are products that will do that for you. They're labeled that way, and it'll kill the entire root system out, and it can be used that way. So there are products that'll do that for you.
Yeah, there's it's an interesting thing. I've known some people that are involved with woodland restoration, and they actually will use herbicidal products, and they do exactly what you said, is that you cut it at ground level, and then they just literally paint or spray it right on the stump itself. You don't spray anything surrounding. And one theory about that actually is they feel like you, when you pull up a large root ball from a honeysuckle, you're disturbing the seed bed, and you can create more problems for yourself. I still say any herbicide I recommend not using unless you have to.
That you know, when you make that cut, you're opening kind of the plant up, and when you put that product right on top of that wound, it is moving right into that plant, and it'll go right through that root system and kill it all out. So it really is one of the, I guess, safer ways to eradicate those rather than spray the entire foliage. I think your way would be preferable.
Well, I don't think spraying the foliage would even succeed. Yeah. And also, that's another situation where the restoration people have told me that doing that in the fall is more effective. It's not saying that it's not effective now, but again, the saps and everything is receding into the earth, and so they take it down into the root ball and kill the plant.
John, thank you for the phone call. We'll continue our gardening conversation and get to your phone calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Here to discuss how to get our lawns and gardens growing well and looking good, and to answer your questions are Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Jenny in Erlanger. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about yourself?
Good. I have a question about the knockout roses, and mine are showing the evidence of the Rosetta rose virus.
Mm-hmm.
And the only option I've been told is to dig them up and burn them.
That's about it. That virus is inside the plant, and you cannot, there's no spray or anything that will eradicate it. And once it's inside there, what you want to do by taking it up and getting it out of your landscape is to keep it from spreading on the mouth parts of other insects. And root grafting, I guess, is another way that it can be transmitted. So I would definitely take that advice. And, you know, the knockouts were, they came out as being foolproof, but we've really found since they've come out that they are prone to some diseases and some insects and obviously that virus.
Is there anything you could use instead that would be just as colorful?
Well, there's of course, quite a few other roses besides the knockouts. I mean, I don't know whether it's because they're so plentiful. that we're seeing so much of it, but I'm getting samples into the office on a really regular basis of the rose rosette virus, and I'm not seeing it on other rose types nearly as much as I am on the knockouts. But then again, there's a lot more knockouts out there than there are of anything else. So I would, I would really check with your nursery people. There are some great shrub roses and some other things, some landscape roses that you might want to look into.
Okay, so there's no miracle treatment out there yet.
There really is not for viruses are really difficult to control. There is systemic inside the plant, and we just don't have anything that'll knock those out.
Jenny, thank you so much for the phone call. Let's talk with Jim in Norwood. Hi, Jim.
How are you today?
Oh, good. How about yourself?
Not too bad.
Good.
I was just going to mention about transplanting. I use vitamin B1 anytime I transplant anything. It's really inexpensive to use, but it will stop transplant shock. It really took a lot of new roots growth out. Very beneficial to the plant.
When I was in the nursery business, we actually used it, and I couldn't really tell, but there are a lot of people who swear by it and think that it does exactly what you say it does.
I used to import trees from China, and they would come in bare roots, and I had like a 98% success rate using that as opposed to just putting them in pots and if I had in a pack.
I'm wondering, how did you get trees coming in from China?
Bonsai trees.
Okay. All right.
Had to go through all the phytos.
Sure. I bet. Yeah. That's not an easy task.
No, it isn't. But it was worth it.
Yeah.
Jim, thank you for the call. Let's talk with Vicki. Good afternoon, Vicki.
Good afternoon. Okay. Here's my question. I actually have two, so I'll be quick. I have some kind of vine that has come up in my flower garden that. It's a real thin leaf, and it's very sticky, and it's a vine-like thing, and it gets tall, and it wraps around everything, and I don't know how to get rid of that. That's my first question. My second one is I have planted bush beans last year, and for some reason I can't keep the rabbits out of the garden short of putting a fence around it. Is there some kind of plant that will keep them out or something I can put around?
Short of putting a fence around it, that's about it. Rabbits are tough. I mean, there's repellents, but honestly, chicken wire fencing is really, and if you can just fence the bush beans, if that's all they're getting into, just fence those, and that should take care of it. But rabbits are tough, but the chicken wire fencing is effective, I think.
Yeah, and you can once the beans are starting to mature and the rabbits are getting in there, you could put up the fencing and leave it temporarily, and then after your harvest is done, take it away. If you know, because I know some people don't want the aesthetics of a fence in their yard year round, and that might be a temporary sort of solution. I know some people put bird netting on top of it, and I've just kind of found that to be a complicated mess later on, and it just gets tangled and birds get caught in it and stuff. But I mean, and some people also use lightweight row cover, and just weight it down on the sides with, stones or brick or pieces of wood.
Vicki, thank you for the phone call. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And, Beth emailed, she has black-eyed Susans that have not flowered in 2 years. So she's wondering if there's a problem with the soil. And also she's wondering, how do you keep the deer from eating the plants?
Black-eyed Susans really are pretty dependable as far as blooming goes. I can't think of it unless the deer are eating off the flower heads, and that would explain it. But I can't really – that's a plant that almost can become a weed in certain situations. And as far as eradicating the deer or getting rid of them, again, there are repellents, there's soaps, there's a lot of different things. There's alarms and different motion detectors that you can implement. And, some people use all those and still have issues. But I think there's, deer are just one of those things that we really have to keep trying and trying to find a way to not eradicate them, but to make your yard, your whole landscape less inviting for them.
Yeah, I'd say that's the most common question we get is how do you keep deer from eating plants?
Yeah.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Tom emailed. He has vines growing up the sides of his trees, so he wants to know, should he cut them off at the base, and will pulling the vines off the trunk hurt the tree?
Won't hurt the tree. There are some vines that actually will grow straight up. It sounds like these are a weedy vine, so I would probably, you know, go ahead and remove those. But we've actually seen ivy. There's some wonderful trees at Spring Grove Cemetery that have had ivy growing up on them for decades, if not centuries, and has no effect on them whatsoever. So it's the ones, the vines that grow circular that will do some damage and of course, strangle the tree. So you don't want those, but some of them, and just doing what he said is, and, you know, just taking a piece out of the vine so that you mess up the transportation system and then pull the bottom part off.
Yeah, I agree with what Dave just said. Also, if the vines are up in the tree, if you let them just kind of, if you wait a while and let them die back, when you go to pull them off, they're going to be less vigorous and they'll just cut, or soften, they'll just fall off on their own.
Let's talk with Susan in Finneytown. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. We have a Japanese maple. It's been in the ground for about 4 years, and this spring, the top two-thirds did not leaf out at all. We have some branches near the bottom of the tree that did leaf out. Can we save this tree?
What's it going to look like when you prune all the dead out?
That's going to be the strain.
Yeah, and you know, you'll get new growth to generate. But, you know, that's I always get these questions and I say, is it going to enhance your landscape or is it going to detract from it? And that's the decision that you've got to make. I really think we've had two, problematic winters back to back. And a lot of that is, I think, winter damage that you got in there. And, we saw it on an awful lot of, Japanese maples as well as some hollies and boxwood this year. So the plant is not dead. It's going to come back. It's going to generate some growth and it's just a matter of whether you can live with it or not.
Thank you very much. Should we do anything this spring?
I would. You could fertilize it very lightly and just water it during dry periods. And a little bit of mulch is nice, too.
Okay.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate the call. Let's talk with Kuniko and Mason. Good afternoon. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Hey, I'm a first-time gardener. I bought this Miracle Grow pod for tomatoes. And I planted them in the dollar store buckets that I had, drilled some holes underneath and did that. I'm wondering, when would they start giving me tomatoes, and is there anything any special care that I need to take?
Well, when you talk about the buckets, is this like a 5-gallon bucket, or I'm just curious how big the planter is?
The planter is, say, 1 foot, like it's a big. Yeah, it should be a 5-gallon bucket.
Oh, okay. I mean, determinate variety tomatoes or patio, what they call patio tomatoes, can be grown in small containers like that. But generally, it's best for a tomato to be planted into the ground. And it was interesting. I was out at housing authority.
It's flourished pretty well because leaves and everything have grown tall and nice and strong, but I don't see any flowers or any fruits in it. And I was wondering whether it's already time and they're not going to give any fruit.
Well, it's just very early. I mean, you don't start getting tomatoes till midsummer. So I wouldn't worry about that. The one thing you're talking about using a particular fertilizer. Don't over fertilize and don't over water the plant, because you keep giving it those nutrients, it doesn't have, it will actually impede its production of buds and flowers and then fruit.
Not over fertilize.
Yeah, I would not. I mean, it's hard for me to not seeing the plant, but you may not need to fertilize it again till midsummer.
They usually say fertilize it when the first fruit comes on. They're about the size of a dime. Then go ahead and fertilize it at that time. And then you can kind of back off for a month or so and then maybe put another liquid product on. But, one of the, as that tomato gets larger, it's going to have a really a much heavier demand for water. And during a hot, dry summer day, you can almost have to water those twice a day because they just dry out quickly. But keep an eye on it. And you should be getting fruits in July or so. And a lot of people are successful with the buckets of tomatoes.
Thank you for the call. Let's talk with Brad in Kentucky. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we sure can.
Okay, my question is, my parents have a rose bush. We've had it for several years, and it keeps growing to 10 to 12 feet tall and about 6 to 7 feet wide. We don't fertilize it. All we do is water it, and we cut it back to about 6 inches every year. How do we get it to stay smaller outside of cutting it, like, every 6 months or every 3 months?
And you're talking about a rose bush, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Some of those old fashioned rose bushes will do that. They're pretty vigorous. You know, genetically, that plant wants to get the size that it's got there. And if you want to keep it that way, you're probably going to have to keep pruning it, fairly regularly. But, I mean, does it have a nice flower on it?
Yeah, I mean, it blooms, like, it's started growing about 2 months ago, and it's already, like, some of it's already 6 feet high, and we've had blooms for about a month and a half.
Well, that's, unless you want to move the site or move the plant to a different location, that sounds like you're going to have to kind of live with that. I don't know of any way you can continually to you know, unless you just prune it all the time, and when you do that, you're taking... You know, you may be stressing the plant in the long run if you continue to remove leaves from it, but it sounds like you might want to try to find a better place for it in your yard.
You know, it sounds like an antique variety climbing rose.
Yeah.
And so, and that's the nature of that plant is to grow and to climb and to, you know, send out these long, long branches. It's almost like a vine. So, I mean, if you want a more compact rose or a compact plant, you probably should do some research, go to a nursery and explain to people what you want, and they can recommend a variety like a bush or a hedge rose that'll have some height and volume to it, but not be, you know, so expanding.
Thank you, Brad. And let's talk with Harry in Brown County. Hi, Harry.
Yeah, hi. Some of the local nurseries now have some native fruit trees like persimmons and pawpaws. Do I need to buy more than one of those? Or are those self-pollinating or what?
Some of the persimmons, you know, I'm not positive. I think it always helps to have two for cross-pollination. And I would suggest that you do that, but those are both really interesting trees, and I'd love to see people use them more. Pawpaws have become very popular. It's a great understory tree. It actually does well in the shade of some other trees. And then persimmon, that's just a incredible, if it's the native persimmon, it's just incredible bark and beautiful tree.
Yeah, with the persimmons, you do need more than one. And then also with the, also keep in mind, a persimmon tree is not like a semi-dwarf apple tree. It's 40, I don't know if it gets 60 feet maybe. Mm-hmm. It's a very large tree. So keep that in mind when you plant it. The other thing with the pawpaws is that they grow in colonies, and so they spread out from one another. And so it's recommended that you have pawpaws from two different colonies to ensure pollination. But we've been developing a grove of pawpaws at home for, they're 8 years now. We still, it's slow growing. We still haven't gotten any fruit.
The pawpaws really vary by cultivar and in how they taste. And some of the wild ones, can be very good, but there are some named cultivars. If you go on, Kentucky State University's website, they have listings of some really good native cultivar, pawpaws that are just outstanding fruit.
Thank you, Harry. And time for one last quick question here. Ben emailed, he just removed a maple from an area next to his neighbor's yard, and he wants to know, is there a dwarf tree or a pear tree he can replace it with that would not intrude into the neighbor's yard?
please don't plant a pear tree. unless it's a fruit-bearing pear. But the ornamental ones, we've got to quit planting those. But I think there's a lot of trees that would fit that bill. And I would go to your nursery, any of the great nurseries here in Cincinnati, and get one of the nurserymen to recommend something to you. And I think you'll find a medium-sized to small tree that would just be perfect there.
If you was thinking about a fruit tree, I mean, the variety Seckel, you can get it as a dwarf or semi-dwarf. They do well in this region.
Right. Yeah, David and Peter will be back next month if we didn't get to your questions this time. Peter and David, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Peter Hunninger is co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds. The technical director was Rick Andres. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next on 91.7 WVXU.